isolated sector of our solar system. Suspended in orbit around the sixth planet from our sun lies a distant outpost. A technologically perfect world where mistakes are impossible. Because the impossible is unthinkable. It is called Saturn III. Each year for 22 days, a solar eclipse plunges this outpost into shadowlock. Total darkness. All communication is terminated. This year, the inhabitants of Saturn III are about to experience the unthinkable. A nightmare so perfect, it could only have been made by man.
Captain?
Major.
This is my partner.
There are only four inhabitants on Saturn III. One of them is not human.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Horror Hangover, the monthly and exclusive podcast for subscribers of Legion Podcasts. This month we have a real mess of a movie, but in that way that makes a movie so compelling, you can't help but stare. It's a great big traffic wreck of a film, with big stars and a lot of promise, and somehow isn't a Star Wars movie. I kid. No, this movie is Saturn III. And before we get too deep into this, I want to give full credit for much of this information to Gregory Moss's fantastic repository for all things Saturn III, which is entitled Saturn3MakingOf.com. So if you're listening to this, you've heard most of the information there, but it's worth a visit for the incredible stills from the film and the production and a peek at the missing drug trip scene that I'll mention later. So thanks, Greg. So, what the hell is this movie anyway? Well, it began with a guy named John Barry, a production designer who'd worked on such big-ticket movies as A Clockwork Orange and Superman and Star Wars. While working on a movie in 1975 with director Stanley Donen, Barry said he had an idea for a gothic sci-fi horror movie set on Titan, one of the moons of Saturn. The basic premise he proposed was a food research scientist whose lives are thrown into turmoil when a psychopathic inspector shows up to check on the goings-on and fire up a robot for use on the station. Donen wasn't crazy about the idea of directing a sci-fi film, a genre he didn't particularly care for, but he thought Barry might be onto something, and encouraged him to write an outline to take to producers. Barry himself described the story thusly. In Saturn III, the science considerations are all responsible. People don't do anything that isn't possible. It's very much about real people, he said. It's a love story, a story about contemporary relationships set two centuries ahead. That sounds all right. During the production of Star Wars and Superman the movie, Barry wrote a draft of the script and handed it off to Yvette Mimieux, director Stanley Donen's wife, and perhaps best known to genre fans as one of the stars of The Black Hole. She loved it, and handed it back to her husband, who felt the material was good enough for Barry to propose directing the film himself, making it his directorial debut. While Donen liked the script, he also saw its flaws and need for a professional hand, so novelist Martin Amy was brought on to do a new draft. Donen handed this new draft to a powerful producer named Lou Grade, who read the script on a flight. As fate would have it, on that same flight, Farrah Fawcett was sitting nearby. Lou Grade hands the script to Fawcett and asks if she would like to be in the film, and by the end of the flight, Grade had a deal for Fawcett to star. The problem was, Grade didn't have the rights. The story goes that Grade called Donen and asked, "Hey, how would you like to have Farrah Fawcett in the movie?" Donen said, "That sounds great." Grade said, "Fine, well, you have her." and the deal was made for Grade to secure the rights to the film, now with a script and star attached. However, the script may not have been all it was cracked up to be. Fawcett would later say the script she agreed to was not the shooting script, and not that that is particularly unusual. More tellingly, Steve Gallagher, the writer hired to do the novelization of the film, said, quote, "The script was terrible. I thought it was bad then, but in retrospect and with experience, I can see how truly inept it was. That may not be Ami's fault. Years later, I met someone who'd worked on the production, and she told me that every script doctor in town had taken an uncredited swing at it, so it's impossible to say whether it was stillborn or had been gangbanged to death," end quote. In addition to the script troubles, Barry, who was still on board as director of his first feature, was given a budget of $10 million, putting the movie in a much higher tier of budget than Barry had intended for what was supposed to be an intimate portrait of relationships in a sci-fi setting. Add to this turmoil Spartacus himself, Kirk Douglas. Initially, Donen wanted Sean Connery for the role of Adam, the role Douglas would later secure, and Michael Caine for Benson, the role that Harvey Keitel would eventually get. Unfortunately, both of those actors were avoiding shooting in England due to some nagging tax problems. So Donen then goes to Douglas, who had just finished a really awful Western comedy entitled The Villain or Cactus Jack, depending on how your region is titled. Douglas agreed to the project almost immediately, stating, quote, "These days, I only do movies that excite me. I'm looking for a challenge, something new. The idea behind this film is so fresh, so different to anything else I've been offered in the realm of science fiction, that I didn't want to miss out on it," end quote. Douglas would become exactly twice as old as Farrah Fawcett during production, doubling her 32 years of age. Keitel was then added to the cast, and now the production was ready to go. Barry, who had been a production designer on some of the most influential sci-fi films of the 70s, hired his old assistant, Stuart Craig, to join him on the film as a full-fledged production designer. It was he, Stuart Craig, and Colin Chilvers who would work together to create the robot Hector. When it was done, the set was one of the largest self-contained sets ever created for a film. In fact, a map had to be posted on the soundstage for the crew, who would easily get lost in this labyrinth. Most of the heavy lifting revolved around construction of the robot Hector, though. As Donen said, quote, "It was enormously expensive because of the number of man-hours that went into building the robot. Actually, it wasn't just one. We had many. It wore out, so we had many covers. We didn't have many arms, but each arm was separate, and each arm had a team of men working on it. We had three teams working offstage, each with a set of radio controls. We had a crew of 20 working with this one robot. The robot was generally radio-controlled. Occasionally, there was somebody inside it," end quote. So, production challenges, sure, but at least we have an old-fashioned movie star at the helm. Except Douglas was horribly behaved on set, according to the stories that emerged. Martin Amy, the guy who wrote an early draft of Saturn III, later wrote a novel entitled Money, which was a thinly veiled account of his time in and around the production of Saturn III. In the novel, an aging actor demonstrates a propensity for getting naked for the crew. Amy said of Douglas himself, quote, "When actors get old, they get obsessed about wanting to be nude, and Kirk wanted to be naked," end quote. Douglas was also up in arms about Fawcett's hesitance to perform nude in the film, again according to Amy, saying, "What do you mean she won't take her clothes off? She's only a fucking TV actress. I'll rip her clothes off." I mean, Fawcett was not in great shape on the set either. Her previous film had tanked at the box office, and her famous marriage to the $6 million man himself, Lee Majors, was on the rocks. Between the two leads' personal issues and a robot that worked only sporadically, things were not great. And only 2 weeks into the production, the director and the guy who came up with all of this in the first place, John Barry, was canned. Donen later said in an interview, quote, "It was my fault, not John's. The truth is, John had hardly ever been on a set, which I didn't realize. He was such a terrific talent, but he'd spent most of his time in an office. He knew next to nothing about staging a scene or handling actors. And since nature hates a vacuum, the actors jumped on him. The film started floundering. Finally, I had to tell him, 'It's not working. I'll have to be on the set with you.' I had a moral commitment, after all. I'd make sure the film went all right, but when I did turn up on the set, John said he just couldn't work like that, so he left. There was no question of his being fired. End quote. A separate account from cinematographer Billy Williams contradicts this, though, saying, "There was nothing wrong with the first 2 weeks' work, except that we were a little bit behind, and we were behind because it was taking so long. Anytime we had to do something with the robot." And Kirk Douglas had complained that the director was spending too much time with the robot, but it was inevitable. In fact, the picture went weeks and weeks over schedule because you couldn't avoid the fact that the robot had to be in certain scenes. Some believe that Douglas had intentionally poisoned the well on set for Barry in hopes of getting the job of director for himself, but Donen stepped in to handle the directing duties. Barry would be hired onto The Empire Strikes Back after leaving Saturn III, having previously worked on Star Wars. Only 2 weeks into his work on that film, production designer John Barry died at the age of 43 of a rare form of meningitis. Many believed his time on the set of Saturn III had weakened his immune system to the point of near eradication. But whatever the case, Barry was a talented guy, and by many accounts did not deserve his treatment at the hands of the cast and crew of Saturn III. Meanwhile, back on the set, Donen found that working with the animatronic robot was just as tough as Barry found it. Between that, the fact that tubes on the costumes kept popping off, and the now notorious lack of cooperation from the film's stars, Stanley Donen still managed to cobble together a movie. Save for one scene, which has only recently been made available. If you Google Saturn III, you're bound to run across some posters featuring Farrah Fawcett in some fetishy outfit, hands on her hips. This does not appear in the final film. It was part of an extended sequence involving a drug called Blue Dreamers. Fawcett and Douglas share a pill and get goofy. Fawcett muses about going to Earth and says she has the perfect outfit for coming out to the planet she's never seen. Hence the fetish diva outfit. In this scene, cut from the theatrical release, Douglas ends up killing Keitel's character in a fantasy sequence while Alex, Fawcett's character, watches. Farrah Fawcett eventually demanded the scenes with her in the outfit be stricken from the film, but the image was nonetheless used for promotion. Now, a couple of other notes before we get into the film itself. One, Harvey Keitel's voice is notably not his. Word is, producer Lou Grade hated Keitel's Brooklyn-based accent and demanded that the actor redub his lines in post-production. Keitel, whose experience on the film was not great to begin with, nor did he have any love for Grade himself, told the knighted producer to suck it, leading to English actor Roy Dotrice redubbing all of Keitel's performance. It's a jarring watch to see this affected, flat, Midwestern accent come out of Keitel's mouth. And also, Elmer Bernstein did the score, which sounds great, except that it got chopped up, because producers didn't care for his use of rock music in the score. So the award-winning composer's work was largely cut from the film in favor of a more atmospheric, electronic soundscape kind of thing. And what about the special effects? They are terrible. But it's also the result of the budget for the special effects being downsized when Lou Grade's other big movie in production at the time, Raise the Titanic, started to go incredibly over budget, and Saturn III became the piggy bank from which Lou Grade drew his money to finish production on that film. In fact, some of the effects were acquired from the series Space 1999, shots that were never used on that television show, but were available to Lou Grade, who also produced it. Alright, so enough about how this movie came to be. Let's get into the result of all of this production trouble. And here to join me to discuss this movie, the ins and outs of the plot, the characters, their motivations, really the subtle genius of Saturn III, is my pal and yours from Kiss the Goat, one Jeffrey X. Martin. X, sir.
Hello, sir.
Welcome to the weekend.
Oh, yes. Need it.
And this, of course, is a discussion of the film Saturn III. I've talked a bit thus far about how the movie came to be. And on the back end, we'll talk a little bit about the repercussions of such. But it is up to us, sir, to talk about what this movie is at heart. And I kind of put a call out to some folks. I was like, hey, I'm talking about Saturn 3 if anyone's interested. And there were a couple of people that were like, yeah, I'll give it a watch. And you were the first person that was like, no, motherfuckers. Saturn 3 is my jam.
Yes, very much so.
And that's what I want. I want the passion here because there's no other way to get through it. On one hand, I would tell everyone to watch Saturn 3. On the other hand, you never need to see Saturn 3.
It's not a casual watch.
It's you. Yeah,
you have to be bound and determined that you are going to just sit down and see this thing through to the bitter end.
Which is only, you know, what, 87 minutes?
Oh, yeah.
Or 84 minutes, I'm sorry. And it feels like a goddamn eternity. All right. So we start with the movie with a completely non-evocative shot of Saturn and a big, long ship, crossing the screen, much like a Star Destroyer from Star Wars.
Now, as this ship approaches, you can see, like, a rotating disc underneath it. I guess that's supposed to be a communications dish. But it's bent all to hell. It's just wonky. So the first thing you see is a busted-ass spaceship. And, like, you feel sorry for it. Like, it's a cross-eyed cat. Like, oh, honey.
Yeah, well, it's
the... You can't hunt.
It's the alien-like grittiness of this world, X. Things are busted up.
Okay. Is that what it is?
No,
okay.
It's just... this, like, you're right. From jump, it's like, are they fucking with us? We go to the interior of this ship, presumably, and they try to do kind of a 2001-y thing where they mirror the shots and you can see people like walking above and below as if the gravity is weird or something.
Right.
And so they're calling out for the captain. They're like, hey, Captain James. Hey, you get the fuck to your pod, man. You're about to have to go to Saturn 3. And then we are introduced to Harvey Keitel in this film, and who plays a character named Benson. And Benson is bananas, is the technical term for it. Like, he was supposed to go on this mission to Saturn 3, and he failed his psych test. And James reminds him of this. And then James kind of casually watches as Benson secures himself to the wall with a fucking seatbelt. And then opens the airlock and sucks this dude out.
So, here are questions.
Please, let's begin.
Why is their locker room built over the airlock?
Sounds like a poor decision. I agree. Go on.
Why didn't Benson freeze when the other guy did?
Well, we're in the suit, question mark.
Okay, so his helmet is essentially a Yeti cooler, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and he's also got the tubes on his suit.
Oh, that's right. Those tubes filled with
heat. They're heat tubes. And I'll go you one further with the airlock. Why would you rig razor wire across the airlock chute so that as soon as it were opened, should you be sucked out into space, you're immediately sliced and diced before you ever get into the dark vacuum of nothingness?
You should never hitch a ride on the SS Argento.
Yeah, it's... Like, it's just a fucking death trap. It's amazing that any of these people are alive, I suppose. So Benson ejects Captain James into space and then books it to the pod, which also looks kind of dopey. It's not a... It kind of looks like an update of like an actual lunar module or something, where it's a lot more glass and you can look out and whatnot, but it's still got those kind of lunar lander pads, except it takes off, kind of. And I mean, it's just a bunch of smoke, and then we see it lift up, and you know.
There's one more. Yeah, there's one more thing I wanted to mention too. As everybody is coming in to like equip this ship, and they're all dressed in black, like, you know, shock troopers, which I don't know, those may be in white. But anyway, it's just this army of faceless people. On the back wall, and I guess this is the logo for the whole Saturn survey program, but it looks like a very stylized R2-D2 head. Like R2-D2 designed by Bob Fosse. So this really just looks like the worship center for droids, like a droid cult.
Yeah, and that would be a more interesting movie for sure. Yeah.
It's like something you'd see like in the Denver airport.
Right. I don't know. Maybe it's just commissioned art. Maybe it's their thing. There's no way to tell. There's no way to tell what happens to anybody in this movie. It's all just horribly, horribly written, and as I mentioned in the upfront, like the rumor was that everyone took a stab at this script at one time or another when it was in production. And by everyone, I mean, as a child, I had gotten the script for a pass at the tender age of 9, and to this day, I stand by the Blue Dreamers as absolutely integral to the plot. We'll get to that nonsense.
So
Harvey Keitel, posing as Captain James, flies a miniature over other miniatures, that are like the wrong side of good Godzilla movies miniatures. Like, they're all kind of shitty.
This is worse than the Hoover Dam breaking in Superman 79.
It is 100% that quality or worse throughout the film. So that ain't where you want to be, folks. So Harvey Keitel lands, and for the first time we see the two people occupying Saturn III, which is a botany station, aka Garden of Eden. Where Kirk Douglas as Adam, I think you may see some of the symbolism, and Farrah Fawcett, who is in fact not Eve, but is Alex, they are hanging out waiting for this dude to show up, Captain James. Unbeknownst to them, it is actually Crazy Person Benson, who steps out of the pod. And, you know, he is from, I guess Earth, kind of like everybody has these weird tattoos on their face that I suppose tells you if you've been to Earth or not.
What are those?
I don't know. Like, do you get a tattoo at birth if it's like, hey, you've never seen Earth? And what is the purpose of that tattoo? Just to say you've never seen Earth, so it's a conversation starter?
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if there are clans. Like, that's the thing. It's not like this movie does world building, where it's like there are all these questions and we want more information. It's just a bunch of shit that is in the movie and you're like, well, what about this? And they're like, nah, whatever. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's fine. Just accept it for what it is. Just accept that everybody got ink stamped at some point in their life and just never washed it off.
And, all right, so they go inside, like, they go out to the pad to greet Benson, a.k.a. James, and drag him inside, and they have to go through the airlock or whatever, which is basically just the swirly tunnel at a funhouse. And then on the other side of it, they finally, like, take off their helmets, and Kirk Douglas is like, you know, here I am, Kirk Douglas. And then Farrah Fawcett, you know, shakes out her hair and, you know, Harvey Keitel might as well be like a cartoon wolf in this scene where he's just like, ahooga!
And the first time he speaks, you realize, hey, that ain't Harvey Keitel's voice. And, you know, again, I mentioned this in the upfront, but it's so distracting in the film because there's no question what Harvey Keitel sounds like. You know, I've seen Harvey Keitel and his dick in so many movies,
right,
that I feel intimately familiar with the man. And it is exactly like, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know, paging Mr. Herman. Mr. Herman, there's a telephone call for you. And it's like, that's not right coming out of his body. And that's how this feels. But so he's got, Benson has this canister. And they're like, what's that? And he's like, don't touch it. And they're like, well, what is it? And he's like, I can't tell you. It's a secret experiment that only I, Captain James, wink, wink, have access to. And he's like, so what goes on out here? And they've been there for 3 years at this botany station, just fucking and doing research. Cause that's all this is just one big botanical fuck pit.
Which really not a bad gig if you can get it.
Right. Right.
I'm going to grow some corn and then I'm going to go fuck.
I mean, if you're Kirk Douglas, it's absolutely a great gig.
Because it's designed specifically for Kirk Douglas and his goddamn googly eyes.
Right. Like old 64-year-old Kirk Douglas in this movie, hanging out and, you know, cinematically banging 32-year-old Farrah Fawcett is, I mean, again, it's a great gig, as you said, for this guy. And, you know, immediately it's pretty clear Benson wants in on a little of this action, you know, and
he's so, pretty blatant about it.
Absolutely. So they like invite him in and to their little, you know, kind of living room, essentially. And they're having a drink and whatnot. And everything is, you know, what they do establish is that Earth has pollution problems and food problems. And that's why there's this botany station on Saturn III to learn to grow food in the vacuum of space to provide for the people of Earth, as well as, you know, people starting to move out among the stars. All of that sounds way more interesting than it really is in the movie. And then we get a tour of their kind of setup, which is just a bunch of vats of green-colored liquid bubbling. And they don't really seem to do it. There's kind of a garden going on, but it's like, well, you can grow a garden almost anywhere if you got lights and shit.
It's mostly ficus trees.
Yeah, right, right. And it doesn't seem to be food. It's just like, can we grow plants here? Like, which seems to be the wrong kind of science to be doing, but whatever. Look, I'm no scientist. And quite frankly, neither did these people seem to be. So after they show, the folks around, Kirk Douglas kind of unwisely is like, hey, Farrah Fawcett, why don't you show this horn dog to his quarters? And on this trip, Harvey Keitel is like, hey, you want to do some pills? You want to do some lewds? Except it's not lewds. It's Blue Dreamers. And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, what do you mean? You never heard of Blue Dreamers? Oh, man, they'll kick you back. And then he gives her a Blue Dreamer, which she doesn't immediately take. And she just kind of takes it back with him and goes back to her fuck pit with Kirk Douglas. And, you know, that's where we first get a little bit of conversation between the two and an inkling that maybe Kirk Douglas feels insecure in this relationship now that Benson has shown up. And again, there's a decent movie to be made about an older man and a younger woman at a research station, and a young man shows up that becomes a temptation.
Well, it could have been Knife in the Water in space.
Right. Something like that. I mean, and particularly because you're using these biblical names and some of the imagery, there's also an interesting movie to be made about two people who have this ideal life, and then somebody comes to corrupt the Farrah Fawcett character, which ruins the whole thing. That would also be somewhat of an interesting film. But what happens here instead, X, let's not give it too much credit. is instead they just decide they're gonna do some fucking and they're gonna take a blue dreamer, which leads to this like psychedelic scene. And as I mentioned in the up front, this is the moment where Kirk Douglas has this kind of drug-induced fantasy about killing Benson. And which, again, makes the movie a little bit more interesting because it highlights this sense of him feeling threatened that something has come to their station to disrupt their idyllic life. And then we kind of cut to the next day where we get to see Kirk Douglas doing jump ropes. And I wonder how many takes that fucking took.
Probably just the one. Probably just the one, because he was still virile and potent and was damned insistent that everyone realize that.
Yeah, and I mentioned this earlier, but there is much speculation and certainly enough rumor to say that it is entirely possible that during the production process, Kirk Douglas just showed everybody his dick at one of the table reads to prove how virile he was. And in fact, someone noted that just this was a phenomenon among aging actors, that as they start to crest that peak of being a sex symbol kind of character, that they just suddenly want to show everybody their dicks.
I still got it, Eddie.
Right. I think that's a fascinating phenomenon. And I kind of hope it's true. I mean, it's terrible, but I also kind of hope it's true. So then we get a scene where Farrah Fawcett is kind of bombing in on Harvey Keitel as he's unpacking his shit, slowly assembling this robot that we'll get to. And Harvey Keitel, Kirk Douglas is in a control room or something, so he can hear all this. And Benson is like, "Your body is very beautiful. I'd like to use it." And that's how he puts it. Like, "I want to use your body." And she's like, "What?" And he's like, "What are you talking about? Like, that's just how we do it. In fact, if you were on Earth, you would be legally obligated to let me fuck you." Which is bizarre. Like, I don't know what is going on planet Earth. But again, one of those things, they mention it, and then they're kind of, "So what about that?" And it's never brought up again.
He actually says that's penally unsocial, which, that's a hilarious pun if, you know, you hear it like I did.
Well, so he propositions her and is like, "I don't understand what the big deal is. Why aren't we fucking?" And she's like, "Well, that's not how we do things here on Saturn III." And then she and Kirk Douglas go jogging through the station. And he's, without letting it slip that he's heard all this, Kirk Douglas is like, "Do you like him? Do you want to be with him? Like, do you want to go to Earth? At some point, you're going to want to leave me and get out of here." Again, all of this is a more interesting movie than what it's about to become. Not a great movie, but an interesting movie. But then we have to cut to Benson, a.k.a. Harvey Keitel, putting together his robot named Hector. And it's basically a big brain in a jar. It's a learning computer that he slides into the robot. And the whole idea here is that it uses like an organic brain to learn. right? I mean,
yeah,
that it has programming, but it's also kind of a blank slate.
And the brain looks like spray foam insulation with small copper wires attached.
Yeah, it ain't great. And the head of this robot is really where things get super stupid. Because it looks like the innards of a toaster with glowing red eyes.
Look, this is one reason why Hector is my favorite evil robot, because he's about 8 feet tall, and he's got giant metal abs and arms that can crush things, but his head is a desk lamp.
Yeah, yeah. He's got the Johnny Five head on a mutant Terminator body. And because you're right, like it has the styling of the robot, like just look it up. I'll have an image on the episode as well. But it, you know, it's got like this chrome musculature over the chest and everything and looks kind of rad up until you get to the head.
Hector's a butterface.
Yeah. Hector is a butterface robot. That's a shame. So. Anyway, they Benson goes to show off Hector to Kirk Douglas and Farrah Fawcett, who have been tripping on the Blue Dreamer. And he's like, hey, check out my robot. And Kirk Douglas is, you know, an old man and afraid of technology and doesn't trust the thing. In fairness, like Harvey Keitel tells him to. Tells the robot to hand Kirk Douglas a cup, and he crushes it because, you know, he's a dumb robot. He don't know nothing yet. And Harvey Keitel's like, well, he's gotta learn stuff, and we're gonna teach him. But it's cool, right? Like, we got this awesome robot, and he's the only one who seems real excited about it. But in the next scene, we learn that the way that Hector learns it is via direct input, or one of the ways he can learn is through direct input, which is Harvey Keitel plugging a thing into Hector and then into the back of his head. And so basically Hector is learning by copying parts of Harvey Keitel's brain, is the way I understand it.
Now, I will say that this is the first example that I can remember of a film ever showing an IO port in the back of someone's neck.
Yeah, and that part of it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And even the idea of, like, again, there are ideas that make this movie more unfortunate because of how it could have been good. And the idea of, hey, this thing is basically learning from Harvey Keitel's broken, abnormal brain, and so is then... a crazy robot as a result. And that's kind of what the story is. But it's just, it's told in such a muddled way that, and like, anyway, we'll get to what fucking happens with this robot. But, so now that he's given him the brain upload, Harvey Keitel drags Hector out to play chess. And, you know, they're... just kind of like showing off how this robot can move chess pieces and whatnot. And that's the point where Harvey Keitel reveals to them, hey, I got this port in the back of my head, and that's how I can teach this robot how to play chess against you and whatnot. And, yeah, there's a little bit of conversation in this scene as well about, well, you can't teach a robot compassion and stuff like that. Like, lofty robot AI ideas that are never really fleshed out.
Never understand sacrifice.
Right, right. You know, like, what it means to be a human. anyway, there's... while they're doing some of this direct input shit with Benson and the robot, Benson is looking at Farrah Fawcett and thinking all kinds of deviltry. And now we understand that the robot is learning to lust after Farrah Fawcett, because every man and pseudo man does in this movie. That is all she is in this film.
Yeah. Oh, she's a slam piece and that's it. But I think it's interesting that since Benson comes from a society where apparently free use is the norm, he is just nothing. He is the worst Redditor in the universe. That is his character. He's just a bad Reddit asshole.
Yeah, 100%. He is absolutely willing to give you his opinion on anything and everything, and it's always horrible. So, you know, he's still trying to make time with Farrah Fawcett and saying, like, I can take you back to Earth. And then she gets some shit in her eye, like, as he's making time with her or trying to make time with her. And she's calling for Kirk Douglas, and he's like, fuck that, I got this crazy-ass robot here. Hector, come here. And so there's this scene that goes on for far too long where Hector the robot has to pick a thing out of Farrah Fawcett's eye, showing that he can be, I guess, good as well as evil, or show that he cares about Farrah Fawcett, or I don't know. Like, I don't know ultimately what the point of this scene is other than, oh, he can pick things out of people's eyes too.
I thought it was just to show that he was precise and potentially gentle. But when you watch the scene and he is trying to pick the, they call it a live chip. And I don't know what that means because it was a rock. It's not a live chip of anything, but he doesn't get anywhere close to her actual eyeball. So I don't know what he was plucking, because he's nowhere near that woman's eye.
And so Benson follows up the, hey, I just saved your life or eyeball. I don't know, whatever it was. And so how about we talk about fucking again? And she's like, I thought we'd gone over this. And he's like, what, are you afraid you're going to like it? And that was one of those lines that's like, ew, this movie's gross. And once again, Kirk Douglas is in on this. Like, he is hearing as he walks into the room. And Benson is saying, like, that old man is yesterday, baby. Get with me. I'll take you back to Earth where it's just a fuck, fuck, fuck-a-rama all the time. And then, you know, Douglas makes his presence known, and they're like, oh, sorry, Grandpa's here.
And he keeps using this terrible lingo. At least twice he refers to himself as not being update enough to understand, you know, Benson's thought process or activities on Earth anymore. And kind of that, the language that they use on this station is just terrible.
It's like Farrah Fawcett seems like this naive nymphette that was discovered on the planet, the only kind or one of her species or something, even though she's a person, but there's no indication of, like, where did she really come from? If not from Earth, was she born on a colony? Was she a scientist? Is that how she got here? Did she just hook up with this guy? Like, none of that is ever addressed. I don't know.
She's like Nova.
Right. Yeah. She's Nova from Planet of the Apes, only at least in that movie, there was a reason for that character to be there. And I'm not sure what that reason is in this film. Other than the reason to have all the guys want to, you know, fuck her as much as they want and whenever they want. Seems to be her place in the film.
Because apparently none of the guys in this movie can make a fist.
Well, and I mean, it kind of comes to that, but I mean, not masturbation, but, like, even if they would just fight over and be done with it. But again, it gives her no agency in this film.
She has zero agency.
Even at the end of the movie, it's just her doing what she's been told to do.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating that, like, because, you know, say what you will about Farrah Fawcett as an actress, but she went on to do some pretty good work. And I'm not saying that she's doing good work in this movie, because she's not. But also, good Lord, what do you have to work with? Anyway, so we, you know, are once again just kind of spinning our wheels with another scene of Kurt. Like, that's the frustrating thing, is none of this shit ever moves forward. It's just, hey, you know, I'm last year's model, baby. And maybe you want to get on with things. But this scene happens a couple of times. But at the end of the day, she's just like, I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. Because she can't make up her mind. She can't decide nothing. It's not her place. It's the place of a man to tell her what to do.
Yeah, she's never had that option to make a decision.
Yeah, that's what it seems like. And it's fucking crazy. Anyway. You would just never see a character like that. Speaking of Nova in War for the Planet of the Apes, that character Nova had more agency in the film, which was a child.
I was going to say she was like 8.
Right, a child being carried on the backs of monkeys, and she still had more thrust in the plot than Farrah Fawcett does in this film. Anyway. All right, so let's get to the next scene, which is Benson and Hector chit-chatting as he's like, what do you think about Farrah Fawcett? And the robot is like, yeah, she's pretty, but I think she's pretty because I think, like, you think. And also, you're a fucking murderer, dude. And the robot calls him out, and he's like, delete that. Delete the murderer stuff. And he's like, okay, you're a fucking killer, dude. And he's like, no, delete all of it, like the whole thing.
That was an improper thought linkage.
Right. Until finally he, you know, Benson is convinced that Hector has forgotten that he is a, you know, psychopathic murderer. But, you know, that's what's really the underpinning of the remainder of this film is that Hector the robot has an abnormal brain that wants to kill or is capable of murder. And
he has a full-on robot chubby.
And he's got a hard-on for Farrah Fawcett, like every other male figure in the film. And so Farrah Fawcett, speaking of, is going after the dog. Like, they're looking for the dog. Ugh.
Which is where her affection really lies.
Right.
Lies with Sally the dog.
And quite frankly, Sally probably treats her better than anyone else in the film. So she's going looking for the dog, and out comes Hector, like, chasing her through the robot garden. The robot is just has a boner for Farrah Fawcett, and picks her up by the arms. And finally, Benson comes in and is like, Farrah Fawcett, the robot has a hard-on for you. You tell him what to do. And she's like, put me down. And the robot is like, you know, must comply, hottie. And programming for hotness. And he lets him down. And then Benson and Kirk Douglas, like, have to fight the robot. And try to, you know, take it down. And as they're doing this, Kirk Douglas is completely ineffectual. Farrah Fawcett doesn't even try. She's just watching to see what the men accomplish. And Benson gets kind of got by the robot. We don't really see what happens to him initially. I'm sorry. Getting ahead of it, because initially we actually do stop Hector the robot. We think he's down for good. And another big problem in this movie, one of the setups is that we're on the dark side of Saturn, so we can't talk to the spaceship. So the Adam and Alex can't call and be like, hey, this dude showed up with a crazy robot that's trying to fuck my fuckmate and also trying to kill us. Get somebody down here. And
there were an eclipse. They're shadow locked for 22 days.
Right. So they're kind of on their own as they're fighting the robot. And now Benson and Adam are kind of uneasy allies because they've got this robot that they were able to get down long enough to trap it in the plant lab. But now it's just tearing shit up, trying to get out. And they're like, well, we've got to stop this thing. How do we do it? And Kirk Douglas, of course, is the one who's like, I've got an idea. How's he recharge? And there's a not very tense scene where Hector plugs himself into the recharge port. And it's like, oh, the angle's bad on this camera. Is he got the thing in him or not? Oh, wait, he does. Okay. And then they overload the circuit or whatever and theoretically blow Hector up.
Which cracks me up because you would think that a high-functioning machine like that would have a built-in surge suppressor.
They didn't come with power conditioners back then.
Apparently not, yeah.
For then. Not back then.
And you know what? During
the future.
Just to jump back a little bit, during that whole fight scene, to me, Kirk Douglas is just like a senior citizen drill bit tailor.
Yeah, it's a lot of just like him kind of swaying his body. Whoa. And like he fights like Captain Kirk.
Yes.
You know, of like, I'm going to put both hands in one fist and hit somebody on the shoulder. You know, I mean, he fights like he fights in an old movie, and that's what he's doing. And yeah, it's like all of this action stuff is really poorly done. So once they overload Hector, though, they run down to the lab, and Hector starts to get up, so they have to just jump on him and like hold him down, you know, and then. Benson removes his brain core. And Kirk Douglas is like, you know what? Take you and this robot and get the hell off my station. And anyway, so they're talking about what the name Hector means. Like he's dragged around the walls of Troy and stuff, which will come back later. And meanwhile, while Adam and Alex are just having a drink and chit-chatting, where Kirk Douglas is like, hey, the thing I learned about all of this is that I couldn't bring myself to kill Benson as much as I wanted to. I'm not that kind of person. I'm a good guy. I'm the hero of this picture. And Benson is disassembling Hector, I guess, to figure out what went wrong or just to make sure he stays dead.
That's what I thought, was just to make sure he stayed dead,
but it kind of don't matter,
right?
Because all the individual parts are like, hey, we're Hector parts, and now here's like the arms in the lab are now reassembling him. And I don't like, why is his brain wired into the station, or, and why does his brain or his head work without the brain part of it?
I don't have answers, Paul.
Right. Paul. I just like, it's one of those things. Like, I don't understand why he's able to reassemble himself. It seems like they did the job of disassembling him.
Yeah. I don't, I got nothing.
Okay.
I want to have an answer. I want to have an answer, and I don't.
Okay. I'm just covering my bases, making sure I'm not missing something essential.
No. It is complete nonsense.
All right. Good. Whatever. So
it is.
So Benson is like, all right, I'm going to get the fuck out of here. I have been kicked off this planet, and clearly my robot doesn't work.
And I'm not getting my dick sucked.
Right, I'm not getting it wet on Saturn III, so I'm going to go somewhere where I can. And so he makes a pit stop in the bedroom where he's like, you know what, Major, talking to Kirk Douglas, you're inadequate. which is great. I'm sure that's the very thing Kirk Douglas was afraid of, both as a character and in real life. And so we get some pretty quality Kirk Douglas ass as they roll around the room and fight, as he tries to prevent Benson from taking Farrah Fawcett. And Farrah Fawcett finally has to, like, pull Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas is just too much of a man and has just about done killed Benson. And she's like, stop it! Stop it! You're gonna kill him! And
he's called upon his reserve dimple power.
By the power of dimples! I got two cheeks and a chin dimpled up, baby! So Benson hasn't given it up, though. He's all like, Kirk Douglas is all tuckered out from having beat him up. And then Benson, like, whacks him in the head. And Farrah Fawcett is being dragged by Benson towards the ship. At which point, Hector, Deus Ex Hector, shows up to lop off Harvey Keitel's hand for no reason. And, I mean, not no reason, I guess just to do it. Lopping off hands can be fun, I suppose.
I always thought that was an accident. I don't know.
Whatever, but he, like, lops off his hand and just drags him off.
Maybe it's just a call back to Fingers.
I mean, who knows? Who knows what the fuck is going on in this movie? So it lops off his hand, and then, Alex and Adam, like, Kirk Douglas has made a miraculous recovery, and they're gonna use his pod to get the fuck out of there. And then they realize, like, oh, shit, this robot is loose on the station, it's trying to kill us, we gotta scamper underfoot like Newt from Aliens for a while as this thing hunts us. But it never... Like, it's one of those serial killer or slasher movie things where it's like, Hector moves kind of fucking slow. You just need to pick up the pace a little bit and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, he's not difficult to outrun.
Right, but it turns out, like, he's fucked up the airlock or something, so they can't get out. So they're kind of trapped on the station with him, I guess? Anyway, I mean, like, just this interminable period of time where Hector is chasing them around. They're running around the hallways, and then, oh my God, here's the robot. Let's run the other way.
Is this the right time to ask why the escape ship had a remote detonator?
Yeah, so that's the other thing, is that the remote pod... Bloop. Yeah, I don't know why you would have a remote detonator in the thing that's supposed to save you in just this eventuality. I mean, fucking Saturn 3, just makes some sense, because none of it does. And, like, I mean, there is seriously, what, 20 minutes of them just kind of running from room to room? Until they finally get around, maybe not 20 minutes, but it's a solid 10, 15, of them just kind of scampering around while the robot slowly walks after them.
Mm-hmm.
And until they get the super idea that, like, oh, let's disguise this big hole in the floor that we have that Kirk Douglas was filling up earlier. I don't know what the fuck it is. Some coolant or whatever. And we can disguise it the way you would do, like, throw leaves over quicksand. And Alex, Farrah Fawcett, is going to stand on the other side of it. And when the robot comes in, he's going to, you know, auga Farrah Fawcett and walk over these loose tiles and then cause him to go crashing into this coolant water shit.
The thing that this sequence really needed... was Scooby-Doo chase music.
Yeah, well, it's like the robot is like, haha, you're not going to fool me. I see that maybe these tiles have been moved. And so it like throws a rock and it busts one of the tiles. And it's like, see, look how clever I am. But then it just goes to the tile over that is also a fakey tile. Like, the super smart robot was like, I bet you guys used a fake tile. Mm-hmm. There it is. And then just assumed that they would not do it again.
Do you remember the old board game Stay Alive?
Maybe?
Or there were marbles and you could slide pieces of plastic back and forth and eventually it would reveal a hole. So you would just
you would just
fall through anyway. That's what this is. This is a big game of Stay Alive with a dummy.
It's again one of those things where you're like, "Well, this doesn't make any goddamn sense." Like everything else in the movie, but yeah, it's like I'm a super smart robot except for how I'm completely stupid. So yeah, but it doesn't stop it. It just gives them time to try to escape, which is when they discover, hey, he fucked up the airlock. We can't even get out of here. So all this whole scene has managed to do is land them back where they were before the scene began, which is trapped on the space station with a crazy robot. And there's a whole lot. Like, another major problem of this movie is that it just continues to recycle the same scenes. You know, it's a different setting. Like, hey, one time we're in a hallway, and one time we're in the grow lab or whatever. But in either case, it's just, he's almost going to get us, but we got away. And the only thing really pushed forward is that we get Benson finally showing back up, and it's like he appears on the video monitors and they're like, James? Because throughout this movie, they never know that he's not Captain James, which is another thing that's stupid. Like, why isn't there that reveal of like, oh, you're not even you're this weirdo that is posing as Captain. Anyway, I don't know why I'm criticizing the movie for not doing smart things with its story. It never does it, not once. So, so Benson comes on the video monitors and is like, you know, I'm all right. I just want to come inside. And they're like, the last time we saw you, you had your hand chopped off by the robot. And he's like, I know how that looked. But me and the robot are cool now, and we want to be all cool together. So just come meet us. And so they do, because they're dimwits.
Listen, I hear things out here. I want to come back inside.
Right. You watch Hector, and you watch him close. So there's a sequence where they're running towards the lab. And again, I don't know why they're running. Like, it's just closing doors behind them. And the robot is counting on them running through the hallway. Otherwise, it would just trap them before it ever got them to the door that it wanted him to get in. I don't know, man. Anyway, so
there's a problem here that all of this kind of runs towards, and that is there are no locks on any of the doors in this space station. Or on this station. Right. So
yeah, I know. And, all right, so here's another thing that pisses me off about this movie. So we finally come face-to-face with Adam and Alex and the robot, which we have discovered is imitating Benson's voice, as well as wearing the top half of his skull as its head, which is kind of badass.
I dig that.
Yes.
That's okay.
It is the one point in the movie where it's like, oh, he has absorbed Benson, and therefore he even tries to emulate Benson appearance-wise, you know? Like, I would have gone further with it with, like, trying to stitch some skin on his arms and legs.
Absolutely.
And everything. But it doesn't go that far. But, so, this should be a moment of, terror and excitement, and we should have some either battle or conversation or something. And instead, we get the reveal, and then Farrah Fawcett swoons, and Kirk Douglas just, like, bends down to grab her, like, creaks down, oh, Jesus, and gets down, puts his arm around her, and looks at the robot with one of them Kirk Douglas, you son of a bitch, kind of looks. And then we cut away. And it just cuts to, hey, there's now this spaceship flying over Saturn III, because we're out of Shadow Lock or whatever it is. And the ship is like, hey, Saturn III, what's going on down there? Everything cool? You guys haven't been killed by no crazy robots or nothing, right? And, like, they hear the radio report come in, but then they hear, like, Kirk Douglas's voice. Oh, wait. First, let's talk about Kirk Douglas waking up. Again, I don't know what happened. Like, I don't know if Hector knocked him out and then he comes to... I don't know, man. None of this. So, he wakes up in his room and he's now got a port in the back of his head. And we hear Benson, a.k.a. Hector, saying, like, you know, I can now read your thoughts and blah, 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 and also can program you when I decide to do that. And which, again, is a compelling idea. Like, what if a crazy robot could program you to serve its needs? Something that, like, Phase 4 that we talked about on the last episode is a really cool movie about kind of the same thing. But at any rate, this movie doesn't do nothing with that. It's just something they mention and is never a thing in the movie. And so, you know, then you hear Kirk Douglas's voice being emulated by Hector telling the spaceship, hey, everything's cool down here. And they're like, hey, what about that hot piece of ass you got down there? How's she doing? And he's like, oh, you mean Alex? Alex, come here. And then Hector emulates Farrah Fawcett's voice and is like, I'm doing great down here, just fucking. And they're like, okay, well, we'll see you when you get up to the station. We'll do some fucking up there, too.
Well, we'd like to space bone you.
Yeah, I mean, everybody in this goddamn movie. Even the, like, the pilots swinging by just to chit-chat are like, hey, what about Farrah Fawcett? God, this movie's so bad.
It's like, you know, and I hate to compare, but when you think of characters like this, even Pris in Blade Runner, who was a replicant and B, a pleasure model, has more agency in that film than Farrah Fawcett as a human thinking person than the replicant did.
Well, yeah, but so that's the difference, is that Pris wanted something. Like, she had motivation. She wanted to survive. And Hector doesn't even seem to be doing that. Like, his motivation just seems to be crazy. Like, what is he... I guess maybe the sci-fi concept behind this is that he sees human beings as inferior, but he just also has the hots for Farrah Fawcett.
Garbage in, garbage out.
I mean, I don't know. Like it would be so much more interesting if Hector was, like, this new life form that had just discovered that, like, oh, I was created by you, but I'm clearly superior, so let me enhance you to make you superior. You know, that's interesting. Like, that's kind of a Borg thing, but why not, you know? Something.
But I don't know what I can do to improve that rack of yours.
Right, I mean... All right. Anyway, so let's hurtle towards the end of this shit pile. So finally, Hector sends Alex and Kirk Douglas out to do work. He's like, you guys have chores today. Now get to work. And Kirk Douglas checks Farrah Fawcett for a port on the back of her neck. And she doesn't have one. She has not been changed. But she sees the one, or feels the one, on the back of Kirk Douglas's neck. And she's like, oh my god, that's disgusting. And he's like, I'm still me, baby. Everything's cool. And So the big plot to finish all this is they're going to, like, Alex is going to distract Hector. And Farrah Fawcett is going to pretend that she now wants to fuck the robot. And, I mean, am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong.
That's the plan. It. And then Kirk Douglas is going to come in and he says, hey, I'm the commander around here. So you're both going to do what I say. And if you want to stop me, Hector, come down here and say it to my face. And Hector is like, all right, you know, when I said I was going to program your brain, now I'm going to get around to doing that. Not really. This movie never does it. And so Hector is going to interface, and like Kirk Douglas keeps giving him the one more thing. Like he's Columboing him time he tries to stab him in the back of the head to like interface with the port on the back of his neck. And he gives this whole thing of like, it's not your fault, Hector. It's not Benson's fault. It's everybody's fault. And
which
so
it's Kirk, not.
No, it's totally Benson's fault. Anyway, so to kill it, Kirk Douglas has strapped himself with, like, I don't know, some kind of mines or detonators or something. And he grabs Hector around the waist and dives into the pool of coolant or whatever that we've recycled yet again for another scene. And then there's an explosion, a big slow-mo explosion of people throwing water into the air and chunks of Hector.
Oh my god, it takes fucking forever for that goddamned robot to explode.
And it is so clearly at times people just throwing a bucket of water. It's really something.
It's like rats in a Bruno Mattei movie. They're just flying through the air. It's terrible.
And so then we cut to a model of the space station, and Farrah Fawcett shows up with much bigger hair than she's had previously in the film. And as soon as she shows up, like, she's got a uniform and everything at this point. I don't know where she got that. I don't know how she got back to this ship, quite frankly. Doesn't ever come up. And anyway, they're like, hey, we're going back to Earth. And then she goes down to Earth. But they're playing, like, this really ominous music as the ship approaches Earth, as if to remind you, oh, yeah, Earth is nothing but a big fucktorium for any woman there. So she is leaving the relative safety of Saturn III and Kirk Douglas for Earth, where it is, you know, the way I read it, penally unsociable, was, hey, you can get charged with a crime for this. And
see, and I heard it as, please be social to my penis.
I mean, either one is terrible, but to me, the implication was that, hey, just the world in general is so terrible that all we do is just fuck all the time. And if you're not on board, then we can issue you a misdemeanor or something. I don't know. Or just get raped. I mean, how about that? That's probably what's happening. But, and then that's it. That's the whole goddamn movie.
Yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah, it really, really is. And so here in a second, I'll get to the stuff about like how the movie was received and the, you know, kind of broken legacy of this film and whatnot. But like as a movie, it just doesn't work. And I think it's broken mostly by the fact that there's no likable character. There's nobody to root for. And all its sci-fi premises are either poorly explained or never capitalized upon.
It does leave you with a lot of questions. And I think the biggest question I had when the whole thing was over was, if this is supposed to be the future, why is Kirk Douglas wearing Hagar Sansa Belt slacks?
my God, the wardrobe in this movie is so, like, 70s future. Like, it's the same, and, you know, I mentioned this also in the upfront, but, like, some of the effects are even borrowed from the television show Space 1999.
No, Space 1999, I had that in my notes. Space 1999 looks way better than this. It's amazing how when he's, at the beginning, when Benson is flying through the rings of Jupiter, he doesn't even have to evade any of the rocks that are there because they're all the same size and they're perfectly arranged in columns and rows. So he can just fly straight in. That's not how space works.
Why fly through the ring at all? Why would you ever have to fly through the ring of Saturn? It's a ring.
You can get around that.
Yeah. It's fucking crazy, man. Like, nobody seemed to ever once stop and say to the people making this movie, hey, these are all really stupid ideas. Why doesn't someone, like, why is there not a script supervisor asking the questions we're asking? You know, why is the airlock right by the same room where they get dressed when they are oftentimes at their most vulnerable?
Why are there so many tubes in this station? And why does it look on the surface like everything is made from broken Seiko wristbands, like for like an old gold watch?
Yeah.
It's
like it looks bad. The acting is awful because, like, Farrah Fawcett's just not very good in it. Kirk Douglas is just playing the old Kirk Douglas hero, but that character doesn't really belong in this kind of movie without an obvious hero. And Harvey Keitel's overdubbing is distracting and terrible.
And yet he still has the best lines.
He does have the best lines, but he's the most interesting character, but that's not saying much.
Right.
And the robot is, like, Maximilian from The Black Hole is the gold standard of killer space robots.
Agreed.
This would be awesome without the head. Like, as we've said, butterface robot, but the face is real dumb. And, like I said, I never feel like this movie pays off any of the good ideas it has, and instead just wants to be a killer robot movie, but it's not even a good one of those. Because it spends too much of its time being esoteric. Like, either be a horror film, like a sci-fi horror film, or be a pure sci-fi film that's more heady and about more philosophical sorts of themes.
Or be the spiritual sequel to Barbarella.
Or that, or go full camp with it. And it doesn't do any of those things. It's head scratchingly bad.
It is. It is a mixed up Rubik's Cube of a movie that never gets put back together.
I think that might be the perfect description to end on. But I don't want to sell you short. Any further thoughts on the film?
At one point in the movie, Hector says, and I can't remember, I don't even remember the fucking context. I just remember the line where he says, just a temporary video inconvenience. And I think that's the perfect description of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He says that to the pilots when they're like, hey, how come we can't see your faces? Are you a killer robot imitating voices or something? Ha ha ha.
No. And we're fine down here. Everybody's fine. We're fine. How are you?
Yeah, yeah. Fucking Saturn 3. All right, man.
But you know what? I will always now say the line, wheel away and wheel and petitate. That is probably my favorite line from this movie. And it's also a great Blondie song. So,
yeah. Like I said in the upfront, I can't recommend someone watch Saturn 3.
Oh, fuck no.
But, man, you should kind of see Saturn 3.
This is, being drunk will help.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a real, let's kick back and watch something that is, go into it knowing that it's not going to be a good movie. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by how not good a movie it is.
It's extremely not good.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. Good times.
And, of course, you can check out Kiss the Goat right here on LegionPodcasts.com. Anything else you want to pimp before I get out of here?
Let's see. Kiss the Goat's 50th episode is coming up. That's a big deal for us because it's taken us almost 5 goddamn years to get to that point. You can also hear me on The Food Chain, which is going to crank production back up here. We should have some new stuff out by March at the latest. I'm on the Cinema Beef podcast with Gary Hill, Theme Warriors with Mike Merriman. I'm going to be doing a guest run on Evil episodes. And I have a new solo show that I'm working on for next year, which I think maybe I should talk to you about that offline. So just cut that part out. But yeah, that's it. I'm everywhere.
The eponymous Jeffrey X. Martin. Thanks again, man. We will do this again on yet another film.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. Bye, everybody.
So Saturn III finally comes out on February 15th, 1980, and the results were not good. The movie was near universally panned by critics, and audiences stayed away in droves, the movie making only $9 million domestically, not even enough to cover costs of production. There is, somewhere out there, a cut of this movie with another 15 minutes of footage. Would it have made the movie better? Maybe. But also, Saturn III serves as a great example of a single creator, in this case John Barry, with a passion for a story being curtailed by the hubris of stars, the reality of production, and the cruel twists of fate. Saturn III is a noteworthy film, not only because it is a uniquely bad movie, but because of what it could have been. It's available now on Amazon Prime, and I would encourage you to take a look, if for nothing more than morbid curiosity. And speaking of morbid, folks, I would encourage you, if you are listening to this, as a Legion Podcasts subscriber, to hop over to our Facebook page, the group page where we host a video little chat session every Monday at 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern, entitled Morbid Mondays. There, it's basically me just kind of chit-chatting with you folks. And, you know, if you have some questions, shoot them my way. I talk about some movies I've seen. No big whoop. Nothing to worry about. It's all cool, baby. But yeah, hey, that's it for this time around on Horror Hangover. Big thanks again to Jeffrey X. Martin for jumping in and talking about this, boy, this real head-scratcher of a movie. And yeah. Check us out next month when we'll be doing another film, either particularly good or particularly bad. But in either case, it is certain to be a fun time. So thanks again for listening, everyone. And keep listening to LegionPodcasts.com. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you all so much. And we'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.
lives. Machines dehumanize.